most of modern cultures, certainly in the quote-unquote West, have been conditioned into an imbalance toward the yang, toward the masculine, the male, the sort of self-protected, you know, et cetera, et cetera. People often think of cannabis as a feminine spirit because it softens that. Allow yourself to surrender to the mother, as it were.
Hope you are doing well today in this sunny afternoon in October, or maybe it's a different time and a different climate where you are, but nonetheless, hopefully you're doing well. My second episode today is with Stephen Gray. He's another organizer of the Spirit Plant Medicine Conference. I really thought that I'd get these two interviews out with the organizers just quickly to kind of highlight this event and its importance in the changing discourse around psychedelics. Many of us have seen the example of the 60s and 70s for all the amazing things that happened and a lot of the negatives. But there's a lot of these conferences coming out, be it Exploring Psychedelics in Ashland, the Psychedelic Science Conference in, Oakland, Oakland, California. So a lot of these things are really starting to open up the grounds of discussion for the potential benefits for everyone for these medicines, or as many people that can benefit from it. A lot of cool research coming out in these areas. This conference itself is in its seventh year, has its own kind of unique view. A lot of interesting presenters and things like that, which we go into towards the end of the episode. Stephen's also the writer of a book that's called Cannabis and Spirituality that's come out recently, as well as some other books. We go pretty deep into the idea of cannabis and spirituality, using it in a ritual, kind of ceremonial fashion rather than just smoking weed kind of ideas. Go into a lot of other similar ideas with cannabis and other ideas that are in the book. The book is a compilation of about 18 different writers of a whole bunch of different topics within the main topic of cannabis and spirituality. Kathleen Harrison, who many know as a former wife of Terrence McKenna, is in the book, as well as people like Hamilton Souther, who is a pretty popular ayahuasca shaman. So really interesting book. Go check that out. We go really deep into the topic here. I did lose a little bit of the conversation about the role of integration, which is probably one of the most important topics, if not the most important topic, to do with psychedelics, so that when you come back after having these peak experiences, you have a way to integrate the teachings that you may have gotten rather than it just being a peak experience and you don't think about it ever again. So unfortunately, I lost that bit, but there's a lot of other good nuggets in here. And again, with the Spirit Plant Medicine Conference coming up in November, on November 4th and 5th, you can use the code word SHIFT if you go to the Spirit Plant Medicine Conference website, and if you were interested in purchasing a ticket, you can use that promo code and receive $22 off. Stephen, towards the end of this episode as well, mentions his own promo code, which you can use if you'd like that one. Either way works, doesn't matter to me. I'd just like to see more people at the conference. And it turns out he was also a student of Chogyam Trungpa for a while, and was a teacher within the Shambhala lineage. So at the beginning of the episode, we talk a little bit about Buddhism and how that kind of relates for him into some of these other modes of exploration.
And I've just gotten my show up on Stitcher as well, so if you want an easier way to listen to it beyond just going to the Libsyn website and downloading it, Stitcher's a great app to be able to listen to podcasts on. It's what I use. And I will soon enough have it on iTunes as well. I just have to do a little bit with my art, get it to the right size, and I should be able to get it on an RSS feed and get it uploaded. But in the meantime, Stitcher's pretty decent, or continue using the Libsyn link.
Hope you enjoy the episode. Without further ado, here is Stephen.
So I went and hooked up with a local center here back in 1980.
The Shambhala Center, or was this?
Yeah,
before?
It used to be. It's the same place on Heather Street there. But okay. It used to be called Dharmadhatu.
Okay.
Yeah, it was his son that changed the name.
That's interesting. I totally thought that it was Chogyam Trungpa who did that, just with the whole idea of the Shambhala Society.
Well, that was so what happened with him was in 1977, I think it was, he took a year-long retreat.
Okay.
And when he came back, he said he'd been receiving teachings from, you know, the spirit or whatever.
Yeah.
And they said that you should go and set up a more secular approach to the same teachings for people who wouldn't necessarily resonate with anything that has an ISM at the end of it. Yeah. Buddhist teachings are very complex and all
exactly.
that. So the Shambhala thing was like a, not dumbed down, just a much simpler,
yeah.
you know, thing that he didn't think necessarily, or people that would necessarily think of themselves as religious
yeah.
might be interested in. So it had the same core understanding.
Yeah.
It was a lot simpler. And so he's set up a stream of teachings with like weekend programs and stuff called
okay.
Shambhala training. Yeah.
Before it became like the Shambhala, when it was more just under Chogyam Trungpa, was it still more of his kind of crazy wisdom style teachings, or was it starting to get more into the secular Buddhist approach?
Well, he had the two streams going mm-hmm. at the same time. One was the way that he taught Tibetan Vajrayana Buddhism.
Yeah.
Which was not necessarily the same as everybody else,
yeah.
but it was pretty close to his tradition, I think.
Yeah,
I
mean, using everything in your life as the method for...
Yeah, well, in terms of the actual, you know, sort of external structures of the sequence of practices. Or,
mm-hmm.
Like, there was another teacher that was around at the time named, what was his name? Kalu Rinpoche.
Kalu Rinpoche, yeah.
Well, you've heard of him.
I've heard about him, yeah.
Yeah, well, he's from the same lineage, from the Kagyu lineage.
Kagyu lineage,
but,
yeah.
for example, and he had a students here at one point. He just started them writing on the Nundro practices, which were the Vajrayana practice, early stage of Vajrayana practices. And Trungpa was an extremely creative person.
Mm-hmm.
He was very open. He, you know, about just whatever the muse sort of said, you know. And he really understood how to meet the Western mind where it was,
yeah.
and what he realized that. You know, and which is one of the reasons he was such a great teacher, was mm-hmm. that he didn't just sort of, you know, transpose, you know, what had been downloaded to him.
Yeah.
He understood that the Western minds were so unsettled and so busy
yeah.
that what they really needed was to sit down, shut up, and pay attention for a few years before they ever got introduced to these Nundro practices.
Just to settle the waters of
yeah.
the mind so that you could go
yeah.
into it.
Exactly. So he set it up in a... I don't know how close to tradition this is, but he called it the three yana approach. Yana
yeah.
means vehicle. So the Hinayana is Hina means narrow.
Yeah.
The Hinayana stage of the path is just the you know, simple shamatha, you follow the breath kind of meditation,
yeah.
taming the mind.
And then there's Mahayana.
Mahayana is where you start to be introduced to more teaching that's gay. Well, it's not just about you
yeah.
know, it's actually about compassion and service.
So that's more like the Vipassana style would be in the Vahayana, or the Mahayana, or is it more some of those practices blend into the three camps?
Well, Vipassana meant different things to different people, I think.
Okay.
Like for Trungpa, it was just a slight extension of the shamatha practice, I think, like
okay.
opening it up a little bit more, but still the basic same practice.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was back in the, I don't know how active they are now, but in the 80s and 90s, there was maybe 70s too, what's his name? Jack Kornfield?
Yeah.
Yeah, him. Yeah, that guy. They had, he and his partner, some other guy's name, I forget.
Joseph Goldstein?
Yeah, Goldstein
yeah.
and Kornfield. You actually know a lot.
I read way too much. Yeah.
They had something that they called Vipassana.
Yeah.
Which I never went to any of their programs, but...
They have, like, the forest... I forget what the yeah. name of the center is, but apparently it's quite amazing down there. But
anyway, there was a group of people here, and
yeah.
they ran a lot of programs here in Vancouver, and they would do these like week long or 10-day type retreats and all that, and it
yeah.
was similar, but their practice was a little different, and they called that Vipassana as well.
Okay.
To Trungpa, I think it meant insight meditation
yeah.
or something.
I think
anyway, that was all part of the Hinayana. The Mahayana was introduced a couple of new practices and just introduced people to the idea of thinking that, well, this first stage was only a stage.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to, you know, start connecting to the fact that you're really here to help serve other people.
Yeah.
And then the Vajrayana was where you go beyond any kind of... sort of what's the word for it? Any kind of conceptual idea of what you know should be doing or
mm-hmm.
whatever, and you just work with energy.
Okay,
yeah.
Interesting. So for you then, I think I read that it was like in 1968 is kind of when you started going to college. Was it around then that you met Chogyam Trungpa? What was
no, I didn't hear about him until I saw somebody reading his autobiography in 1974 or somewhere in there.
Okay,
yeah.
So you had already started kind of down a little bit of the more
like the plant medicines since you had already kind of attended college in 1968?
Yeah, well, you know, Terence McKenna once said that the 60s were misplayed and that most people that took psychedelics were just happy to have escaped without losing their egos, mm-hmm. you know. So, you know, there was little attention to set and setting for
Absolutely.
Most people, and, you know, and I was kind of in that camp. But then, you know, you almost couldn't help finding, you know, something out that was quite stunning,
yeah.
you know, if you took acid or whatever.
Exactly.
You know?
It's like people who do yoga, even not necessarily in, like, the lineage holder yoga way, eventually you can have an experience that shows yeah. you the beyond, but there yeah. has to be a small opening for that to,
yeah.
to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I found that acid was best done in nature. I didn't like being in a city if I was taking
yeah.
LSD, you know?
Absolutely.
You know, so
especially as a non-specific amplifier if you're stuck in the
definitely.
City environment.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, you're out walking in a park or something, even if it's an urban park, you know, then you're around trees mm-hmm. and, you know, moons and stars.
Yeah, and you're connecting
and
more
then
to
it
that.
Goes, wow, you know, that's pretty amazing, you know? Yeah.
There was, speaking of that, there was a question that I kind of wanted to ask. One of the presenters that's going to be coming, uh-huh. Mary Porter,
yeah.
she talks about when you do some of these substances, how important it is, like a lot of people, especially there is the McKennian approach where you would do the 5 grams in silent darkness kind of just in your house.
Yeah.
But Mary Porter talks about like, yeah, that can be beneficial, but one of the biggest things about these medicines is your ability to connect with things like nature. And if you just do it in your house, sure, you can have kind of a deep experience and tap into parts of yourself, but it is more of realizing that you're a system embedded in systems that are bigger than you and smaller than you mm-hmm. that are really part of these deep teachings.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering, have you found that true for a lot of these substances that, it, like what you're saying with LSD, like much better in nature, but with some of the other ones, like even cannabis and stuff like that, have you found similar?
Well, cannabis certainly loves nature.
Yeah.
Kat Harrison's big on that, you know. Nature is like the temple in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I have any kind of authoritative
That's
answer
right.
on that. You know, it's just, you know, whatever would be my personal opinion. I think really the most important thing is to have the right kind of container,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that can be, you know, in the jungle, or it could be, you know, in somebody's basement, you know.
Yeah, as long as, like, that energy is contained.
Yeah, as long as the container is properly, you know, prepared, protected, and the person who's in charge or running the meeting or whatever, you know, understands
yeah.
what needs to be understood.
Okay,
yeah.
that
yeah.
makes sense. Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
Sorry, I guess it's really hard with these things to have any kind of prescriptive, this is how it's done, because otherwise it kind of takes away from the catalyzing ability of these substances for transformation, if there's a specific way that you have to do it, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I've never been big on rigid dogma that
yeah.
way. You know?
Yeah.
It's like my favorite kind of image or metaphor for that is, you know, I've heard that, you know, some bluegrass people will have a total shit fit if somebody adds a new chord into the bluegrass canon, you know?
Yeah.
Wait a minute, you don't put minor chords into a bluegrass song?
Or like Bob Dylan starting to play electric guitar with
yeah,
folk
that
music.
Kind of thing.
Yeah.
yeah. You know, it's the soul that matters, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, how much of you, did you get through much of cannabis and spirituality?
I'm probably towards the end of Kat's chapter. I've had a really busy week with school
yeah,
and
no
stuff,
problem.
But excellent so far.
Right near the end, there's a chapter, I did a chapter, sort of a short introductory chapter on cannabis and creativity, and then
mm-hmm.
I had two people write about the way they use it for
okay.
their creative work. And in my chapter, I quoted Jim Jarmusch, the filmmaker. Do you know who he is?
No, I haven't heard of him.
So he's great, actually. He's sort of he's not, yeah, he doesn't, his films get, you know, distribution in
mm-hmm.
regular theaters, but a lot of people don't know who he is. But Down by Law was probably his most best-selling one. His second most recent one is fantastic, in my opinion. It's called Only Lovers Left Alive. And it's It's not what it sounds like in the quick description. It's two vampires who've been around for hundreds of years. And they do need blood to live on, but they do it in fairly sophisticated ways. Like he gets a job as working in a hospital and sneaks blood out of the fridge. You know? But they're so sophisticated, these two people. Like they're just very kind of spiritual and they're very wise.
So beyond like the animalistic, vampiric.
No, they're nothing like that. Like they're very, very sophisticated. He's a composer of music. There's this one lovely scene. Tilda Swinton plays the woman.
And, okay.
What's that guy's name? Is it Tom Hiddleston?
The one who was...
The male vampire. You know, anyway.
Yeah.
There's one scene, he's got this old Gibson acoustic guitar. Mm-hmm. And he says, I wish I knew what that was. And she closes her eyes, or like he wanted to know like specifically what it was or something. He didn't have all the history on it. Mm-hmm. She closes her eyes and she puts her hands on the guitar and she goes, yeah, that's a Gibson J10 from 1911.
Just immediately.
That kind of thing, right? Yeah. Anyway, Jarmusch, I quoted him saying something like, there's no such thing as originality. Mm-hmm. You steal from wherever you want, but there is such a thing as authenticity. Mm-hmm. So that's what counts. And then he quoted the filmmaker Jean-Luc Godard, who said, it's not where you take things from that matters, it's where you take them to.
Yeah, you know? I think that's really interesting because then it becomes, it's not that, you're taking ideas or whatever.
Yeah.
It's that you become a lens of expression for all of the... whatever those previous energies were, and then it filters through your own physiology in a way that next expression can hopefully be a higher expression that will feed into someone else's ideas eventually and
definitely
kind of continues on from there.
I mean, Turnbull was like that. You know, he just took from wherever. Like, his Shambhala shrine was based on Japanese shrines. He took the zafu, the round cushion, from Zen meditation,
Zen
places and stuff like that. Yeah, just whatever, you know. He took. Yeah. He had the. At our Buddhist retreats, we used to eat meals in a style called orioki, where you had the Buddha bowls and all that, and that was also borrowed from the Japanese.
Okay.
He just took it from wherever and turned it into his own thing.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. I really like that idea where it's not just... I was kind of talking to Selena about this when I interviewed her, and she was saying, or we were saying that she started doing these meditations and cannabis meditations, but it wasn't, I've read all the Buddhist books and now I can say exactly what Buddhism says how to meditate. It's, there's a little spark inside of you, and then if you can feel that, and based on everything that you've learned and let it out in its own way, that can be more of an authentic expression, because you're not just trying to copy verbatim what other people might have said was the way.
Yeah, it's always about experience. This isn't on yet, is it?
I think it has been, yeah.
Oh, I
just
didn't realize we were actually going.
I just started it because like the way that I want it to work is I didn't want to... introduce you at the very beginning. I'm going to do like a little bit of an intro before the podcast starts.
Sure.
So I think we started right when talking a little bit
of the choking trouble.
Yeah. I was going to ask, in terms of cannabis and spirituality, since we're kind of on that topic, with the kind of like dosing and the way that you're setting up the ritual, how do you kind of set up, not necessarily set up your own ceremony, but like, what do you find important in terms of the ritual aspects, in terms of smoked versus kind of something like edibles? Mm-hmm. How does that play into the holding of the space?
Well, one of the wonderful things about cannabis is it's a very gracious, kind, flexible plant if you treat it with respect and use it properly. So there's a lot of different ways to do things, you know. So my way is just one way, you know, and that could keep changing as well, right?
Yeah, you had an interesting quote in the book of, I forget who said it, but it's the people's psychedelic, and that it's more gentle and easy to get into the resonance of.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and not necessarily just because of the fact that it's more gentle, but partly at least because of that. It's, it just is our plant. I called it the people's plant. Jeremy Wolf, who is a contributor to the book, called it the people's psychedelic.
That's it, yeah.
And I just called it the people's plant because it's been our plant since the beginning of civilization and probably prior to that.
The longest cultivated.
People wandering around doing whatever they were doing in the woods and the plains, you know, they probably found the plant, you know, back before anyone called it civilization, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, with that sort of larger playing field, as it were, all those things make a difference.
Yeah.
But the thing is, again, as the people's plant, it, you know, it's for people to discover on their own.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things I love about cannabis is, you know, I wouldn't muck with ayahuasca the same way that you could experiment with cannabis.
Yeah.
You know, ayahuasca's got a narrower sort of channel in that regard. It's so powerful and potentially dangerous, if not understood properly and used in a safe container, et cetera, or any of the, the super strong psychedelics like that. But cannabis is amenable to experiment without much danger of problems, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, for what it's worth, I've done cannabis ceremonies, mostly with friends and so on. And, I wanted to stretch it out so there's edible and
smoked.
Inhaled. We actually used a vaporizer.
Okay.
So we started off with like a candy.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I think is really important for people who are going to do anything like that and just using it on your own, but especially if you're set yourself up in a position where you're, you know, guiding or leading other people, you've got to know that particular material properly, thoroughly.
Okay.
You know, you have to have titrated it on yourself to, you know, bioassayed, I think they call it, on yourself first, so that you know exactly the potency of that, you know.
And that's first, like, the specific strain, you would say, to really understand how that's...
Well, knowing that exact material, you know, like that batch or whatever,
batch.
You know.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, I used to, back before they outlawed edibles in the dispensaries, I used to get these nice little candies. They were a quarter of a gram each, you know.
Okay, yeah.
So I knew, and then I'd chop some of them in half. So I'd tell people, this is a quarter of a gram, and everybody's metabolism is different anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so I'd say, if you can either have a half or a whole, and then you can have another one later if you want. You know?
Yeah, depending on how you're feeling with that.
Yeah, so we start with that and those ceremonies, and then I was kind of working with the same people for several times. So normally, if you wanted to be really careful about it, you'd wait 2 hours after the edible.
Yeah.
Because it can take up to 2 hours to reach full effect,
yeah.
Right? So, but these people I knew fairly well, so I knew that they knew these candies, and I, you know, everything was, you know, kind of covered. So we had a couple of puffs relatively soon after that, like half hour, 45 minutes, because I knew it wasn't going to take them, you know, too far.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
Yeah. And that way, with the edible, I think the edibles or somehow, oral ingestion and inhalation serve each other quite nicely.
Mm-hmm. Because one kind of gives more of that body aspect, whereas one
kind of creates a ground there. And then, if you have a puff, for me personally, it sort of adds a lighter, sharper, I don't know how to describe it exactly, slightly more airy, but more energized quality.
Yeah. And I think in the book you mentioned as well that for a lot of people doing these ceremonies, they find something more of the sativa strains to be a little bit more useful, at least in the ceremonies, because...
Well, that's open to discussion, too.
Okay.
And again, it's the people's plan.
Absolutely.
But, a number of people that I've spoken to, including myself, tend to prefer, the kind of the sharpness, the clear clarity, and the... You know, I almost like I kind of like the word numinous, you know, that sort of it opens up, you know, the cosmos a little bit more. I think that's my experience anyway.
Yeah.
Some people seem to prefer indica-leaning strains because of the more, presumably anyway, more potentially somewhat relaxing and less mentally stimulating.
Yeah, so for
aspect.
Some people that just works better for what their particular need might be. Yeah. With that then, I know for a lot of people when they think, or at least when they think of psychedelics, it's very important to do set and setting, and that's commonly talked about. With cannabis, it's a lot less talked about. People just kind of assume, you can just kind of smoke up, it's all good.
Exactly.
So especially with your book out of Cannabis and Spirituality, I'm wondering for you, how important is the set and setting, and can that really change the experience, especially if you do have it in the ritual setting? Because I know for a lot of people, if you do take a little bit too much of cannabis, it can be very overwhelming to the point that people can freak out more than they would in a psychedelic, a harder kind of psychedelic freak out.
Definitely. No, it's really important, but it's also pretty flexible, you know, like I would say much broader, you know, options for set and setting than, say, again, using ayahuasca as the comparative point. You know, you don't want to have people walking around in the woods, you know, fully in the embrace of ayahuasca.
Yeah.
You know, you want to have them right there where you can keep an eye on them and in fact, help them with the intervention of the spirit, you know, that a properly trained ayahuasquero should have, that connection to spirit, and the Icaros serve that purpose too, the songs, you know. Cannabis is much more flexible, that you know, the out in the woods can be the temple, can be a good setting for it, you know. A lot of it's attitude, a lot of it's understanding that it's, I would say in a similar way to the other psychedelics, and I would like to classify cannabis as a psychedelic, an entheogen. You need to ideally get out of your head, right, and be there for it. You know, people think I think this is one of the reasons for the book, is it, you know, people think they can sort of do anything with cannabis.
Yeah.
That's okay on one level. You know, I don't judge people for how they use cannabis. I'd like to think that it's a benefit to them, and it's not necessarily a benefit to everybody, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah.
Lots of people misuse the planet, and it's causing more harm than good in their lives oftentimes, and you can become dependent on it. You know, some people even might call it addiction, but it's not physically addictive much, not much anyway, not enough to be too worried
but
about.
But can definitely contribute to declination of some people's lifestyles and stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, Kat Harrison, did you say you've read most of her chapter?
Most of her chapter, yeah.
Did you get to the part where she talks about that?
A little bit. I think that's
pages
the bit I'm
where,
in.
She's really good on that. She said in her experience, young men in particular that she's been around, she's noticed they get so seduced by the coziness of that space that they don't want to come out of it into what she calls the daylight world of responsibility and connection. Right?
That's interesting too, because in her chapter there's a part where she's I forget what like group that she's with, but one of them smoking, and he says in Spanish like, "Oh, I'm high. I am in the embrace of the mother."
Right.
So it's kind of interesting to think, especially for men, like to be in that embrace of the mother, to have that motherly connection is very important for a lot of people who might be missing that in the world.
Well, you know, I think it's safe to say that most of modern cultures, certainly in the quote-unquote West, have been conditioned into an imbalance toward the yang, toward the masculine, the male, the sort of self-protected, you know, et cetera, and the softening of the feminizing quality. That's why people often think of cannabis as a feminine spirit, because it softens that, you know.
Yeah.
It potentially softens all that, you know. That's, again, why ideally you want to get out of your head as much as possible and just allow that to happen. Allow yourself to surrender to the mother, as it were, you know, to the nurturing mother, to the earth, in a sense, even, you know.
To really, like, feel that flow instead of think that you're in control,
I thought Chukim Trungpa had a neat little a phrase or aphorism for that. Soft open front and a firm back.
Oh, okay.
So one of the sort of illusions of contemporary society, you know, particularly with men, because women, of course, are allowed to cry in ways that most men don't give themselves permission to, right? So women, for whatever complicated series of reasons, have been allowed to be more vulnerable. Men tend to see that as weakness.
Yeah.
That's changing, of course, but it's still strongly there in a lot of ways, in a lot of places, in a lot of people.
Yeah, and you can see that
they don't understand that softening doesn't mean weakness. In fact, ultimately, it means strength.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the point of all that. That soft, open heart, soft front, firm back means you're not a wimp. You're not cowardly. You're not afraid. You've got that firm back. You know who you are. You're sitting or standing on the ground firmly. Your roots are strong. But you're also not protecting yourself, you know, which is actually cowardice in a way, you know.
So it's being open to the changes and stuff like that without necessarily, like...
Being open in the moment. Being right now. Being unprotected in a sense. I used to have one of Trungpa's little sayings up on my wall, you know, just like an ink blotter thing that I found it on. And it was, he was referring to the Shambhala warrior, and he says, what the warrior renounces is anything that makes him less accessible to people.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
That's a really good quote. Yeah.
So it's like, you know, we grow up feeling like we need to protect ourselves and put this kind of wall around us. Trungpa called it a cocoon, which is a nice metaphor as well.
Yeah, you know? Put up all these masks.
Because a cocoon is something you, in a sense, build yourself.
Yeah.
And you have to maintain all the time. Like, oh, there's a little hole there. Ah! Patch it up, you know?
Like when you get that defensive feeling, that's like, that's very interesting. Yeah. I like that kind of metaphor.
Seeming comfort zone, you know, that we create for ourselves, which actually aren't, because we're actually sort of embattled all the time with it anyway.
That's
so
interesting.
We just think that we're protecting ourselves.
But really, it's really the cocoon is more of a weakness to that expression.
It's more of a prison.
I love that.
And it's a lovely, also a lovely metaphor, because when you are able to let the cocoon, you know, dissolve in the rain, so to speak. It's a butterfly that emerges.
Yeah.
It's something that can fly.
Because instead of like you referencing yourself in this enclosed way when you're letting out that expression, like that. Because then even with the butterfly that would come out, the people looking at that see it as this beautiful thing that can inspire them. Whereas when you just see the cocoon or the caterpillar, it's a small little worm kind of thing.
Good point.
With the cannabis kind of conversation, one thing that I'm wondering about that as well is oftentimes when people are doing other plant medicines, they'll go to combine cannabis with them if it's mushrooms, if it's LSD, which can really change the character of the trip. But what I'm wondering about is I know a lot of cultures and different shamanic practices are very anti-cannabis in terms of a lot of ayahuascaros, but yet with, I think it's, is it the Santo Daime? They're starting to use more and more cannabis as the Santa Maria. So I'm wondering if you could speak to that a little bit.
Can you hold on to that thought for a minute? Because I feel like I didn't quite give you a complete answer to your question about dosage.
Okay, yeah.
We don't need to go too much more into strains. We covered that a little bit. But I want to say a bit more about dosage.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because, in the book, a number of the contributors, including myself, make the reference that potentially less is more.
Okay.
Right? So especially if you're sensitive or if you're not that familiar with the plant, and especially if you're not using it all the time, which is another issue. Less is more can refer to both in the particular encounter and in the frequency of use. I am one of those who lean toward the view that it's, in general, unless you need it for medical benefit where you have to use it every day, if you're wanting to explore spiritual depth with cannabis, I tend to think, as some others do in the book, that it's better to use it less often.
Yeah.
Mariano da Silva in the book kind of says, you know, it's like more like 5, 6, 7 days in between time.
Yeah.
He said cannabis can bring you into transcendental realms, but he said if I use it every day, none of that happens.
Absolutely.
You know? So if you leave time in between, then your experience is going to be clearer and sharper for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
You know? On the other hand, some people, I can't say that it's not spiritual, that some people use it, you know, perhaps even a couple of times a day, puts them in a zone which works nicely for them. It kind of calms a little bit of the anxiety or the anger that they might have, and it sort of settles them in. Some people might say, well, that's just kind of palliative, you know, you're actually not dealing with that material, and that might be a valid point too. On the other hand, I can't really argue if it just puts somebody in a better zone.
Yeah.
However, again, I'll come back to the idea that for deeper exploration in general, I think it's better to leave it some space in between.
Yeah.
So that's that. And then the less is more thing is, especially again, if you're sensitive, you know, start, especially with today's high THC content material, start with a very small amount, like even a one medium kind of toke, like not a big smoke cloud coming out, you know, can be a good starting point. So I think I say in the book that what I often consider the optimal dosage for spiritual work with cannabis is the dosage that you both want to and can handle.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say handle, I mean that you are able to stay present with and able to get out of your head at least for part of the time. If you're starting to experience dizziness, nausea, and things like paranoia and all that, then you've taken too much, and or you're not doing it with the right kind of setting and so on like that, you know. So pay attention to your setting and then come back to a smaller dose and then maybe work your way up, because more is also true in certain circumstances. You know, that if you can handle it, if you can stay calm, if you can stay present and surrender to, you know, this presence in a sense, then you potentially can go very deep too. You know, if I think I say in the book that the stronger the dose, the less other stuff you want to have going on.
Absolutely.
You know, like it just ideally just sit. You know, silence, stillness are, you know, the gateway to wisdom, really.
I think that's really interesting what you're saying in terms of even just like taking the smaller hits, because like if you look at even like Zen Buddhist with tea ceremonies, it's complete mindfulness with the pouring of the tea to the taking of the tea and sipping it.
Absolutely.
So similarly with the hit, really feeling that distribution of energy through you until you know the max amount that you would want to have.
Yeah.
And I think there's a Terence McKenna quote. He obviously had a little bit of a habit with cannabis that he couldn't shake, but he had
problems with it, actually.
Yeah, definitely. But he does have a quote in it saying, like, not in it, sorry. He has a quote saying that although he has this cannabis kind of addiction, he knows that ultimately the best way to use it would be almost like he would do with mushrooms, like wait at least a week, maybe do one of the higher doses. Not necessarily.
Actually,
for
he put it more crudely than that. He said, "Do so much that you think, oh my God, I've done too much." he used the term "slam it" and do so much that you, which isn't necessarily wise. It depends on the person. I think that's why the sort of less is more as a principle is good.
Absolutely.
And then you slowly kind of up the dosage if you want to keep exploring deeper waters.
And I think that's important because it's an unfolding relationship with the plant rather than every single experience is the cannabis experience. It's
not
about, it's a catalyst for growth rather than a prescriptive, this is going
to
happen.
Yeah, well put. And in fact, when you get to Joan Bellow's chapter in the book, you'll see she talks about that.
Okay,
that it's an accumulated learning process over time. It's not necessarily about the high in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, she even hints that the high is, to some degree, a potential side effect, in that people get fascinated by the, you know, the bells and whistles, as it were, and, you know, the sparkle and all that. But really, it's about, you know, well, one way to put that is with a very brief anecdote. I had some very good medicine that I got down in the States one time. It was very, speaking of strains, it was like 80-20 sativa.
Okay,
I like the word numinous, you know, sort of opened up the cosmos or something. So I was sitting on a beach in Oregon, and I had like two tokes, and I was just watching the sunset. I'm sitting on this beach, not many people around, just a beautiful spot, and the first thought that kind of came to me right after having a talk was, this is not a drug, this is reality. It's like you're entering more deeply into the present moment.
Yeah.
You know? The other thing that, in regard to your earlier question that I didn't feel like we quite got was... There was something else. Oh, yeah, method of intake.
Yeah.
There's some interesting ideas about that. Sean and Steve, who have a chapter called Manifesting Presence, I think, in the book, they're shamans that work with iboga and ayahuasca and cannabis. And they're very sophisticated with cannabis. And they both claim that there's something missing with vaporized cannabis. Steve uses the image of musical frequencies, and he says it's as if some of the finer, more subtle higher frequencies are missing. Yeah, so not everyone's going to experience that, and it, and for a lot of people it may be such a fine point that it doesn't matter anyway.
Yeah, I think it would make sense that someone like an Iboga shaman would be able to feel those different resonances.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's just kind of interesting in terms of like a lot of like Native American or just indigenous people would, if they smoke, if it's mapacho, if it's tobacco, it's not vaporized. It is smoke, and the smoke isn't just you're smoking, but it's a communication with with the transcendental realms. So
definitely,
in a way that kind of makes sense to me. Obviously, I guess I don't know to what degree you can feel that, but very interesting.
Man. Well, you know, I experiment with that. I smoke sometimes and I vaporize sometimes, and it does seem a little sharper somehow, and certainly stronger when I smoke. Yeah,
that's interesting.
It's not a really easy one to pin down, but you know, a lot of people are concerned about smoking, you know, in your lungs and all that.
Yeah,
there's reasons to be concerned about that, especially if you're smoking a lot.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, if you keep it down to the kind of frequency that you know that I think is ideal anyway for spiritual work, it's not that big a deal. I mean, if I smoke twice a week and one of those times I have like two or three actual tokes of smoke, I don't think that's doing much damage to my lungs.
And know? Even some of the studies coming out about, like, not necessarily that it's totally prescriptive, but that cannabis smoke as opposed to a control group and as opposed to tobacco smokers, the cannabis smokers have less incidence of lung cancer than even the control group who doesn't smoke at all. But even to me, that seems like smoke is always some kind of irritant, so it probably does something, but still.
Well, there are apparently a lot of the same particulates and irritants in cannabis smoke that are in tobacco
smoke. That makes sense, especially just with the flame changing the content of the plant material.
So that was the other thing I wanted to mention, was that and then there's of course oral ingestion, which is, you know, a whole different kettle of fish in some respects, because it takes so long to come on, comes on slowly, you don't get that sudden burst out into clear air, so to speak, you know, necessarily. So you don't necessarily have the same kinds of experiences, and you have to watch even more carefully for dosage with that, of course. You know, I mean, there's all kinds of stories about people that have taken too much. And
I have done one of those myself.
Most cannabis people have had at least one experience with that until you get to know it. You know, the classic mistake is you eat this brownie or whatever it is, and you know, 3/4 of an hour later, you go, man, not feeling anything. I'll have another one, you know. But it can take up to 2 hours, you know. So then the second one piles onto the first one. And the next thing you know, it's 5 in the morning, and you're lying in your bed staring at the ceiling, and it's moving. And you're like, fuck, I wish I could get to sleep.
Mine was like, I came back from a 10-day silent Vipassana retreat. So I hadn't done anything for a while. And I took, because edibles had just become illegal, and it was just those oil syringes.
Right.
So I took half of a syringe thinking it was one dose.
Oh, yeah.
Turns out that's a lot more than one dose, and had quite a terror-filled experience. But what I like about having gone, not that I like that I went through it, but what I like about having gone through it is it has shown me the power of cannabis as a spiritual tool, but also just as something that, like, it is powerful. It's not that mushrooms and ayahuasca are the things that are really going to take you somewhere. It's everything can be used in a way, as long as you're like mindful enough to pay attention to how it's happening.
Yeah.
But with anything that you can go too far. So it's really, especially with edibles, you need to be paying attention to.
Yeah,
to
and
that.
I think with experience, one can go deeper or take, you know, handle larger dosages, you know.
Yeah.
But that's where this less is more principle is very useful. Just like start gentle, be very aware of what you're, you know, when you have something like that, you know, the first time you do it, like take 2 or 3 of those little drops. You know? Or if it's something like these Phoenix Tears thing, even less. You know?
And small rice grains.
Yeah.
Have a syringe.
Yeah. So now I feel like I've covered that enough for my satisfaction. If you want to carry on to the commingling questions.
Yeah, let's get into that, the combination of it with other plant medicines.
Right. Okay, for starters, I think of cannabis as very respectful, humble kind of a plant that will support, potentially, if it's done right, and it does require knowledge and skill. With other psychedelics. excuse me. It can potentiate the effects of the other medicine. It can smooth and soothe the effects of the other medicine. It can help clarify the insights of the other medicine. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't necessarily imprint its own character that way. Which is, I think, quite remarkable, and that's why I call it a humble plant in that regard. You know, that if you, for example, have a moderate amount of psilocybin mushrooms, and then, say, 2 hours later, after full effects have settled in, you have a puff or two, the likely effect is, at least from my own experience, is that it'll feel like the psilocybin effect is a lot stronger, but it won't feel like a cannabis high.
Even in terms of that with LSD, a lot of people talk about how if you have cannabis with LSD, it's not just that it's the LSD effects, it's not just the cannabis effects, but they make this synthesis into an experience that is neither of them, almost, and it can kind of bring you, not necessarily all the time, but it can bring you into realms that you wouldn't be able to access with either of them, maybe on their own.
I agree, and yet I still think that it's more going to be in the realm of that stronger, or that quote-unquote stronger one.
Absolutely.
If you do that one first, okay, if you take your LSD or your mushrooms or your ayahuasca first, let it settle in and completely establish its way of working with you. And then if you take cannabis, then it most likely, in most of what I've heard from people and my own experience, will not feel like a cannabis high. It'll feel still mostly like that plant's effects.
Yeah.
Strengthened or sometimes smoothed and soothed, but still within its general character.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Its general kind of personality imprint, if you want to call it that. So it needs to be done really carefully and skillfully, and you have to know what you're doing. And again, set and setting are really important for that kind of thing. Mariano da Silva in the book, he's an ayahuasca shaman, actually. And with their inner group, he doesn't do this with sort of more public gathering, because he really needs to know that the people can handle it.
Absolutely.
They will, when they're doing their ceremonies, they have rituals, they do songs and different things, and they will do two and sometimes even three rounds of the ayahuasca. If they have a small group of really people that he knows and trusts, they will have some cannabis after the second round of the ayahuasca. And then in the book he says a lovely little description where he says, the ayahuasca takes you to the top of the mountain, and at that point the cannabis gives you wings to fly in the wind.
Oh.
Yeah, so that's what I meant by the potentiate.
Absolutely. Right?
But also some people say, and also Francisco in the book talks about that commingling, and he says that sometimes it'll just take the sort of edginess off the ayahuasca a little bit, without really diminishing its effect, just kind of gentling it a little bit.
Yeah.
They also use it at the end sometimes for the sharing sessions, because it helps people articulate a little better and sort of ground or
like feel the message.
The insights will come in a little more clearly and be able to be expressed.
So they almost use it similarly to the way that mapacho might be used, not necessarily like within like the ceremony and smoking and like breathing the protection, but I've heard that like a lot of people will use mapacho later afterwards, maybe during the sharing circles, to gain insight a little bit more.
Yeah, I'm not really familiar with that use of mapacho.
Okay.
I know the shamans use it in their healing during ceremonies too. Some shamans will call each participant up individually to sit in front of him, and they'll sing an ikarot for that person, and oftentimes they'll light a mapacho and like blow it on the person first before they start the song.
Okay.
Yeah. Or maybe even during.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. So in as a general principle, To me, it's what I said at the beginning about, you know, sort of there's the dogmatists here. You throw a new chord into the bluegrass canon and they're going to beat you up, right?
Yeah.
And then there's the people that trust the muse.
Yeah.
That's my, I guess you could call it a bias, I don't know, view is that as long as you're coming from the right place, that you're respectful, mm-hmm. you know, and you're doing it for the right reasons and, you know, so on, then, you know, open up, relax, trust, you know, the intelligence of the moment and the creativity of the moment. So, you know, those people that are ayahuasca people that say you shouldn't use cannabis, sorry, but I don't agree.
Yeah.
Maybe not 100% disagree. Like, you know, this shaman I did three ceremonies with in Peru one time, his contention is that cannabis is sticky.
Okay.
And it kind of sticks to your sort of etheric system and maybe even your sort of physical system to some extent, and that it can mitigate or interfere with the visions. So that might be true for some people, mm-hmm. and maybe that's based on some experience that he's had, but I also think that there's some dogma in there, you know, because I don't think that's necessarily true. In fact, there was somebody at that actual ceremony that said he was a heavy smoker and he had a lot of visions, you know, so it didn't seem to make any difference for him. Of course, that's just, you know, anecdotal reported, but still, I think it all comes down to your intention, your knowledge, your skill, your experience, your, you know, way that you work with it in the context of mixing the medicines.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it's hard to have a prescriptive, no, don't do cannabis with whatever,
I think that tends to be more a rigid way of being, frankly. Yeah. That's my opinion.
Absolutely.
On the other hand, it's not exactly the other hand to that point, but it's sort of another view, is that there is also reason to have one medicine in your life that you're devoted to and really, really get to know it. Ken Littlefish from the Native American Church was the elder that I used to work with in that, and that's the peyote medicine. Mm-hmm. And he said that he actually had a contract with spirit that it was very specific and came from spirit. You know, mm-hmm. it wasn't something he made up or wasn't a belief or concept or a dogma of any kind. It was an actual contract. And I think he said it actually came during a near-death experience, mm-hmm. where he was gone for a really long time, or what seemed like a long time, and he was hanging out with the elders in the other realm. And they said, well, Ken, you know, you don't have to go back. You can stay with us.
Yeah.
But if you do go back, number one, you're going to be a healer for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And also, you're never to be exclusive. The doorway is always to be open to anyone who's sincere, not just Native people or whatever. Mm-hmm. And also, you got to just use peyote.
No other.
Nothing else.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So he said, I don't have anything against cannabis, but I'm not using it for that reason.
That makes sense. Yeah. Oh, okay. So for him, it's just the straight peyote, narrow for
just
this.
The relationship with that one.
Yeah.
Some people have said that ayahuasca can be jealous. I don't buy that, but then I can't say that I know for sure. I just don't. I distrust that.
Yeah, and how much, obviously, there are a lot of teachings that come in the states of, like, if it's ayahuasca, if it's peyote. But even there's the conversations of a lot of these things, if the integration isn't done well, it can be, like, an ego amplifier rather than, like, helping you get to terms with it. So if you have an experience, how much of that is an ego projection and how much of that is
this is a
teachings?
Big question, actually.
Yeah.
The first time I ever did ayahuasca, I felt like there were presences there, mm-hmm. you know. I couldn't see them, and it wasn't auditory in the, you know, material sense.
It was just a feeling of...
It was just this sense that I was being communicated to, and that there was a presence actually hovering above, and it felt, like, wonderful. It felt like royalty to me. Mm-hmm. It felt like we were getting these downloads, you know.
Yeah.
It was really interesting, actually. I mean, I don't want to go into it too long, because mm-hmm. I know we're talking about cannabis primarily, but, you know, it's relevant, I suppose. This was a group of people in a yurt, and it was kind of cool, so everyone was in sleeping bags and had sort of crinkly jackets and things like this. Mm-hmm. About every 3/4 of an hour, for 3 hours or so, everybody in the room started to get restless at the same time.
Okay.
And you could tell, because you could hear all the crinkling.
Yeah.
And the shaman, he had a different approach. He didn't sort of guide things much. He laid down with everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But when that happened, he would get up and he'd walk around shaking his shakapa and singing an ikaro, and everyone would settle. The energy would settle down again, and it would go quiet again.
Mm-hmm.
So in the morning, I asked him a couple of questions about that. I said, did he notice that? And he said, no, I just respond to energy, and if it feels like it's time to sing a song. He didn't notice the crinkling, he said. He just thought it was, you know, it's time to get up and sing a song. And then I said, I felt like I was being communicated to, and I said, but, you know, is that just like some version of myself, or is that some other, you know, that's what Terrence McKenna had, the word other, with a capital O, right? Yeah. And he said, that's the question you have to find out for yourself.
that's so interesting. Yeah, because it's the question of because obviously you can go deep in there and figure out your own stuff, but then where is that kind of seminal boundary where the inner meets the outer, and how can you play that boundary?
There's no real way to know,
exactly.
Did you ever read any of the Carlos Castaneda books?
No, but I've wanted to for quite a while.
Well, a lot of people, you know, serious, intelligent people think that he went off the rails after the first couple of books and was just making stuff up.
Yeah.
But that they think there was some good stuff, particularly in the first couple of books.
Yeah.
One of the things was, it was kind of a literary construct. He played the foil of the sort of the naive and thick-headed student, and Don Juan, who was probably a fictional character, played the wise man who was kind of the mirror to him.
Yeah.
So he was, in the early books, he was using psychedelic plants of some sort or another.
Mm-hmm.
He would have these experiences where he flew, and then when he'd sort of come back to himself, sometimes he was a couple of miles away from the cabin. And he'd go back and he'd ask Don Juan, he'd say, okay, did I actually fly?
Yeah.
Or was that just in my mind? And Don Juan would just laugh and say, like, that's a stupid question. There's no answer to that question. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. So Chris Killam had an interesting thing to say about the voice of ayahuasca. He says, if it seems like it's self-serving, good reason to question it, or if it's negative in any way.
Yeah.
You know, if it seems like it's a message of sort of wisdom, you know, that's kind and gentle and serving other people, maybe it's worth paying attention to.
Yeah, I've heard this in terms of, like, ayahuasca, in terms of just, like, spiritual connection to whatever, that if you start to hear a voice that is, oh, you're so great. Oh, you're amazing.
That's what Chris Killam was saying. Yeah.
If it's that, or if it's
self-aggrandizing.
Negative.
Exactly. Yeah. Did you ever read Jeremy Narby's book, Cosmic Servant?
Cosmic Servant. Yeah. I saw it once at a store, and for some reason I didn't buy it. It's another one that I've been
kind of considered a classic almost now, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know if I remember it exactly, so anyone listening to this, don't quote me on this exactly, but the way I remember it, I haven't read it for 15 years, was that he had this experience where he was in the presence of these sort of like lizard-like beings who said they were the lords of the universe, that they ran things. Right?
Yeah.
So in the morning he told his shaman about that, and the shaman just kind of laughed and said, oh yeah, they always say that.
They think they're running the show.
Oh, those guys, ignore them.
That's so funny.
Yeah, so it's an interesting concept, So to sort of sum up the commingling thing, like I said again, potentiation, smoothing and soothing, and clarifying for thought and insight, and let's not be afraid of that, folks, please, but do it carefully, knowing what you're doing, paying attention to set and setting, dosage, all those things, you know, right time, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And if you want to use cannabis as a supporter in those ways of another medicine, do the other plant first, or the other medicine first.
Yeah,
and
find
let
out.
It establish itself first. Yeah.
Yeah, and then once it's fully kind of integrated into your system, then maybe use it to smooth it out. Or
and as Mariano da Silva says, when I was describing how after the second round of ayahuasca they do, they'll have some cannabis in those private ceremonies.
Mm-hmm.
He said, both inner and external silence are essential at that point.
With the cannabis being added.
The addition of the cannabis. Like, you're not going to have songs going or activity going or drumming going or anything. You're just going to go deep into the silence. And that's how that, you know, going from the top of the mountain and flying in the wind thing will actually be able to happen.
Because then you're not being brought back to the top of the mountain.
You're getting out of yourself, you're clearing away anything that's in the way, and you're just being in the space.
That's incredibly interesting. So I did want to switch gears a little bit, sorry about that little pause, into, just because we are kind of coming up on I want to be respectful of your time. So I do want to get into the Spirit Plant Medicine Conference.
Sure.
Maybe to outline some of the speakers and some of the highlights that you think are important about this year specifically.
Well, thanks for asking. Well, first of all, I'd like to say that, you know, I'm biased because it's my baby along with a couple of other people. But I do think it's a really important thing that we have these conversations about these plants and the whole mission of the conference, and not just plants, by the way, but what you might call semi-synthetic substances come into it, like MDMA and LSD, for example.
Mm-hmm.
5-MeO-DMT perhaps gets addressed occasionally, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
They have immense potential for healing and awakening purposes, but they need to be used properly to make best use of them and to avoid dangers, because you can get stuck in these realms. I mean, there were a lot of acid casualties around back in the day, and there may be still somewhat, but people were taking acid in almost any circumstances. And, you know, Stan Grof, he worked with over 5,000 sessions of LSD in the psychiatric hospital in Czechoslovakia, and he watched people go into the place of the central obstacle or wound in their lives, and then he was there, and he and his staff or whatever were there to just help them, you know, this is the container part, the setting part, help them just stay with it and go through it so you can come out the other side. But you can be stuck, you know, you can be stuck in the middle of that and be worse off than if you'd ever taken the substance in the first place.
And that's even like people who will be like, oh, I'm going to take LSD and then go to like a music concert.
Yeah.
And then maybe the situation wasn't amazing for them to be able to go deep. Yeah. But they end up going deep in a place that the container wasn't right.
No.
And they have a freak out there. But if they were, let's say with Sam Grof, they would have been able to
go through it. So that's just one aspect of it. It's also about, having respect for these things, understanding that there's spirits involved, that they're potentially sometimes negative, but also, you know, potentially and most importantly, guides in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding our relationship to the traditions that they come from, a sense of reciprocation, you know, that we're not just taking, an attitude of like, this is a commodity, like you're going to the store and buying a Coca-Cola or something, you know. These plants need to be looked after themselves, you know, and the places where they come from, there needs to be an attitude of respect, responsibility, and reciprocation in that regard. So all of it, sustainability, careful use, all those, we're just trying to participate in how to guide that, kind of understanding and deepen it as time goes on.
Yeah.
So that's the primary reason for it. And then beyond that, we just try to get a lot of different voices from different perspectives. I always want to try to get as many women as possible because they're a little bit harder to find and they have important voices, obviously, because there is a long lineage of traditional, what you might call indigenous people use of these substances. I think it's important to have some voices from those kind of communities as well.
Absolutely.
They have been the keepers of these plants in some cases, like with peyote and with ayahuasca. Even mushrooms, like in Mexico,
that's
up in the mountains and such like, you know, and some places in Asia and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Important to hear these voices,
because
they understand things oftentimes that the non-native cultures don't necessarily understand.
That's one of my big interests, is the idea of the indigenous views towards these medicines, especially because in the advent of a lot of this psychedelic research happening, a lot of the ways that the Western model is looking at the way to use them is specifically Western clinician style. But when we know that it's been used in these indigenous ways for so long, we need to come up with a way to kind of have a marriage of the two systems in a way that it can be deeply beneficial for the most amount of people.
And also we're just trying to, help keep things on track, because with ayahuasca in particular, for example, there are so many people doing it now, and there's so many people leading ceremonies that don't necessarily or haven't necessarily undergone any kind of rigorous training, and maybe of ethically questionable approaches and attitudes and so on as well. So it's important to understand that these plants need to be looked after properly and how to use them and the potential, and understand that, for example, like the Icaros, you know, in my understanding, the authentic ayahuascaeros understand that they got those songs from the spirits of the plants, not just ayahuasca but other plants, and that they are intelligences in their own right somehow. And they will come in and say, kind of communicate to the shaman, I'm the song for this moment.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. If you haven't undergone that kind of training, you haven't developed that relationship with the plant and what you might call the spirit, or what Kat Harrison calls the mother. She says every plant has a mother, you know, which I thought was a nice way of putting it.
Yeah.
That can be extremely important. And just, you know, ethical guidelines, you know, there's potential whenever there are people in positions of power, no matter what it is, whether it's, you know, secular, religious, these kind of things. You know, we have shamans that have, you know, been found to be inappropriate with students and so on, et cetera, et cetera. There's all that kind of stuff, you know, involved.
Yeah.
So we're just trying to help that way.
Yeah, that's one thing I really love about, like, the fact that this conference is in its seventh year, is it really, like, highlights the fact, like, you were around in the late 60s when a lot of the failings of the 60s and 70s for this model was happening. So you've seen the trajectory of some of the problems into a model that hopefully can go forward into betterment. So even just with the idea of my podcast being shifting the paradigm, I'm really trying to highlight these things that are really opening the dialogue for people to look at, instead of holding on to the example of the 60s and 70s and look how bad it was, to open up the idea of look how beneficial it can be.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. And by the way, it wasn't by any means all bad.
Yeah.
There was a lot of excess. There were a lot of problems that were caused by no understanding of set and setting,
exactly,
and reverence for the spirits of the plants and so on. However, a lot of people had amazing openings as well.
Mm-hmm.
And although it's never going to be able to be properly or, you know, fully quantified, I think it's probably not an unreasonable guess to suggest that much of what has occurred in culture since then has been inspired by people who had these experiences where they understood that there was something real and far vaster than their own little story.
Absolutely. You know? Even just into the technologies that we have now, a lot of them stem from
the Silicon Valley people and
or
all that
Jim
stuff.
Jim Fadiman even coming up with the design for the mouse for the computer and things. I think
Steve Jobs,
you
know, with you know, saying he was inspired, you know, that way, and all kinds of people. You
exactly.
know? Yeah.
And I think that's really important in terms of this conference as well, is hearing these conversations, having these conversations, and the idea of coming out of the psychedelic closet, that you don't have to be as scared as you once were to talk about these things.
And it's that's one of the ways that it's going to change, too, is if more people come out of the psychedelic closet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't mean to say that in any kind of casual way, because I understand some people have very important reputations to protect in environments where that would not be understood.
Absolutely.
But sometimes people need to take a risk, and it's, in my sort of anecdotal experience, it's almost as if you could say, when you do that, the spirits are lining up behind you to support you and help protect you. You know, Terence McKenna, in spite of, you know, despite whatever, you know, frailties and, you know, illusions he personally carried in his life, was, I think, an example of that. I mean, he was going around talking in public and writing books about these illegal substances and drawing sometimes fairly large crowds in large venues, and never was hassled, really. You know, I think he said one time some guy from the government, you know, wanted to have lunch with him, and he sat down and had lunch with him and explained what he was doing, and the guy said, oh, okay, or something to that effect.
I think he had a little bit of a role working, and I'm not sure in what capacity, but the CIA actually talked to him in some capacity in terms of, like, employment, but I don't know
I don't
the specifics
that
about that at all. Yeah.
But in any case, some people may need to take a risk. It's interesting you mentioned that one, because Neshe Devano, that's going to be her topic, and I'm really interested to hear what she has to say about that.
Oh, a whole talk on coming out of the psychedelic.
That's the title of her talk at the conference, excellent. Coming out of the psychedelic. I thought where you got it from.
Cool. No,
that's
just the
actual title of her talk,
that's
coming
excellent.
Out of the psychedelic closet.
That's excellent. Wow.
Yeah.
So in terms of the talks, then, could you just highlight some of some of the speakers and a little bit about what their topics are?
A little bit, yeah, sure. Well, so that's one right there. Mm-hmm. Don Davis is a native person from somewhere in the middle north states. I forget which area, Oklahoma maybe. Mm-hmm. And she's a peyote person, mm-hmm. and she's very, her work is involved with sustainability of the peyote cactus in Atlanta.
I wanted to get into that. That's really important.
Let's see now. Mark Blumenthal is an interesting one. He's a little bit unusual for our normal selection of presenters. He doesn't do a lot of psychedelics, and that's not his primary area of interest. Mm-hmm. He is the head of the American Botanical Council, which is a huge organization with a lot of influence, deals with, you know, universities and high up people in, you know, positions of control and influence. Mm-hmm. And their mission is to hold people's feet to the fire about the actual quality of herbal medicines altogether. They're testing a lot of these things, you know, that are on the market, and they're finding that it's not true what they say on the label. You know?
Is that in terms of like things like cannabis and stuff as well?
No, they're not particularly dealing with that. But one of the reasons that I thought he might be appropriate for our conference is that as cannabis moves into legal regimes, that's going to be a more and more important issue, right?
Yeah, it's important,
you know,
even
truth
right now.
In advertising, so to speak. You know, so holding people, it's important right now.
Yeah.
But once it becomes legal and you've got labeled products that say 23% THC, you know, blah blah.
We need to hold
organically
it to
grown, you know.
Yeah.
So is it organically grown? You know, the Globe and Mail study last year, whenever that was, earlier this year, found out that even the THC contents that people claimed, they did 19 samples or something, were not true.
Totally,
and there were molds in them
and
banned pesticides in them, you know. So this is the kind of thing that Mark Blumenthal's organization is studying. So
yeah, I think that's incredibly important. Actually, I also work at a dispensary, and one of the things that I've seen happen is there'll be the CBD pills, and this is trying to help people with some pretty bad symptoms, and you lab test them, and it has literally zero of what they said would be in it.
Yeah.
And then exactly what you're saying, there's a lot of like labs who get paid off by like a grower or something to say, or to like boost up their percentages when it's not that. So I think that's going to be an amazing talk.
Oh yeah, not to get too far away from the conference, but that is going to be such a huge issue with cannabis. Is you know, for example, if they limit the number of producers, that's going to be a shame in some ways, because there's so much expertise out there from the people who've been doing it, you know, in the gray or black market all along. Many of them have become very, very skillful and knowledgeable, and it would be a shame to leave them all out of the picture. However, I could see that if you're a legislator, even if you're open to that principle, you might be thinking, well, you know, if we have too many producers, how are we going to have enough inspectors to keep track of all that and see if they're doing it right and advertising it honestly and stuff? So it's going to be a real interesting conundrum for people to deal with. I hope they don't take too cautious approach and leave it in the hands of a few large producers.
Like the way they want to do it in Ontario, I wanted to get into that with
more distribution, but still, the producer. There's two. There's the distribution and production, right? So, yeah, I think Ontario is totally on the wrong track with their distribution model at this point. But coming back to the conference, there's going to be live music. There's going to be times when you can sort of sit meditatively in the main hall. There's food on site that people can order ahead of time, vegan options, vegan raw and cooked options. There are going to be two evening events that people can purchase tickets for separately. One of them I'm really looking forward to because it was my idea. I was at the MAPS conference in, it wasn't my original idea, but it was my idea for our conference.
Yeah.
Because at the MAPS conference back in April down in Oakland, huge conference, 3,000 people, they had what they called it, a psychedelic comedy banquet. So we're stealing that idea and simplifying it. We're calling it a psychedelic comedy dinner. It's going to be a lot more humble what they're doing in a much smaller venue, and so we're smaller all around, obviously. But I'm bringing in at least one, and hopefully two. He just has to work on a potential conflict of the comics that were at that event that were really funny. Shane Moss and Adam Strauss.
Yeah.
And then Chris Killam is going to sort of be the MC, and he can be very funny too. And you're asking about presenters. He'll be doing two talks.
Oh, cool.
If you're not, if one is not familiar with Chris Killam, he's just an excellent speaker. He can talk for an hour with no notes, and it'll have a seamless, you know, trajectory of beginning, middle, and end. And it'll be insightful, and it'll be entertaining, and sometimes funny, and sometimes poignant as well.
Mm-hmm.
So he's a great resource.
Is Chris Killam the medicine hunter?
The medicine
hunter,
excellent, indeed,
yeah.
And then we're doing a couple of other different things this year. This one I'm looking forward to. I've seen short YouTube clips of this guy. His name's John Sheldon.
Mm-hmm.
He's no exaggeration to say he's a master guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
He toured as guitar player with some of the world's most well-known musicians when he was younger. James mm-hmm. Taylor was one, and Van Morrison was another one. So he plays his electric guitar while telling stories about ayahuasca and his experiences with it.
Okay.
So he's fun. And
that sounds excellent.
He'll be great. Let's see, who else? Trying to think.
Is Tom Hatzis is one of
them? Well, Tom Hatzis, we're doing two, what I call mini lunch hour workshops.
Okay.
Tom did a main stage presentation last year. This year he's doing like a 45-minute lunch hour thing. And I'm not exactly sure what he's going to be doing, but it's going to be like on the history of psychedelics. And he's really into how you language these things mm-hmm. these days too, you know. So he's an interesting guy that way. He's one of, to me, I have great respect for Tom's academic rigor.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to find out if somebody's done their research about the history of psychedelics properly or not, ask Tom.
Yeah.
And he even taught himself Latin so that he could read original sources.
That's
right?
Amazing.
Yeah.
Even when you hear him speak, he has like a very, he sounds like he's gone through a lot of the academic understandings.
Yeah.
And he presents in a very, very intelligent way. Yeah.
He's very bright. He's a really interesting guy because he doesn't come across as an academic at all, except,
mm-hmm.
you know, in his knowledge. But his personal lifestyle, he's more, I think he calls himself a gypsy, skateboard roller or something like that. I used to be involved in roller derbies, or maybe he still is. And he dresses in something that looks like Robin Hood and his merry men, you know, like
yeah.
a kind of a tunic or something, you know, and he'll wear like a garland in his head with, you know, like a little plastic mushroom or something coming out of it, and you know, leaves and things. You know, he's not your sort of stereotyped academic whatsoever, but he's really good.
Yeah.
There's going to be another little mini workshop on the Sunday at lunch with a woman named Sonia Millimaki, who is I forget where she's from, somewhere up in the interior, maybe from the prairies, I can't remember right now. But she, her thing is dieting with local plants.
Okay.
And for those people that are not familiar with the notion of dieting with ayahuasca, it's something that needs to be addressed even more for a lot of people are just going, oh yeah, ayahuasca is the big guy, go do ayahuasca. But if you're serious about really unfolding spiritually and mm-hmm. learning, and especially if you're ever going to lead ceremonies, it's traditionally done, and many people would say really important to work with a variety of master plants.
Yeah.
And you do these, what they call in Spanish, dietas or diets, where you simplify your diet down to almost nothing, just, you know, no spice, no sugar, no salt, no nothing, no sex, while you're doing the diet, and then you take it as a tea or whatever, and then oftentimes they come through in lucid dreams, and they teach you, I've been told by people doing them, pretty much everything you need to know. They'll show you about your past and mm-hmm. the things you need to clear up. They'll even teach you how to work with ayahuasca more skillfully.
Yeah, what I've heard about the dieta in terms of like the power that it can be for people,
yeah.
even if you were to take something like you take all the basic plant, like the basic foods that have no sugar and salt,
yeah.
and then you would take like daily for however long the dieta
yeah.
is, like rose petals or something, not the thorns unless you wanted to work with the thorns, but you
yeah.
would like take the petals, and then exactly as you're saying, when you're yeah. in that ceremonial space, it can come through in either lucid dreams or stuff like this, and it's almost like a visionary state that you would get into, but with the teachings of
yeah.
like Kat Harrison talks about the mother of
yeah.
of the rose yeah. or whatever it is, yeah.
And then in theory anyway, from what I've heard, then also that plant can then become an ally in your work. that you can actually call on it. I did a couple of ayahuasca ceremonies in Peru with a guy who had 8 bottles. They were sort of like large water bottles sitting on this little altar in front of him. Mm-hmm. And before the ceremony started, and they were all filled with some kind of dark, viscous-looking liquids, you know. Mm-hmm. And somebody asked him, "What are those?" And he said, "Well, when I was a teenager, I dieted. These are, each one of these is a different plant, mm-hmm. and I dieted with each of these plants. And so every time I start a ceremony, the first thing I do is I thank them,
yeah.
and then I call on them. And they actually help me, you know, yeah. do and say and guide in the right way, you know?
That's really, yeah. even in your book, one of the contributors is Hamilton Souther,
yeah.
and he talks about when he, not necessarily in your chapter, but on some yeah. podcasts, he talks about when he was in his training for ayahuasca,
uh-huh.
the amount of, in his 12 years of training, the amount of dietas that you'd
yeah.
go through, and especially when you're in combination with ayahuasca and
yeah.
you're doing these plants, just like ayahuasca can almost be a life or death situation in if you're doing it in the shamanic kind of Amazonian way,
yeah.
these dietas, you need to do it in a very, very specific way as well,
uh-huh.
because it can end up being kind of psychologically dangerous, especially if you're kind of mixing.
Yeah.
I
hadn't heard that with those plants particularly, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But anyway, so the idea with Sonia Milimaki's thing is that it makes sense to use local plants.
Yeah.
For one thing, the obvious that they're around you.
Mm-hmm.
But also, she and other people, I think, would say something to the effect that local plants might actually be more effective, like plants from the region where you live
mm-hmm.
might be more effective than plants from, you know, distant locales, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's there. And then also on the Friday before the conference, the day before the conference, a Métis woman named Lori Snyder is going to do a medicinal plant walk. It's going to guide people on to recognize plants around here. So that kind of ties in with the Sonia thing.
Yeah, yeah. That's
yeah.
I think that's really important in terms of especially just the indigenous view that you're going to have at the event, because a lot of that is being like place-based in the land
yeah.
and having a relationship in that system that you're embedded in, instead of just
yeah.
getting food where you don't know where it comes from.
You asked about other presenters. A couple more come to mind that I'm very interested to hear. One is Joe Tafur, who
mm-hmm.
has the book Fellowship of the River. He's an MD. He used to be one of the co-owners of one of the centers down in Peru.
Okay.
And he's also, this is a major theme now that we're getting kind of more and more connected. When we first started the conference, it was more kind of narrowly defined as the spiritual, you know, aspect of it,
yeah.
whatever that means exactly. And then as time goes on, we've sort of focused a little bit more toward also including psychedelic therapy
okay.
in that more sort of narrowly defined sense, like how you work in a therapeutic context with people. I mean, you could
mm-hmm.
say it's all therapeutic context, but also, you know, professional trained people in medical fields using like mushrooms or MDMA
yeah.
or acid or whatever in, you know, one-on-one or small group therapy situations
yeah.
that way, but, you know, to deal with people's psychological wounds and so on. So Joe is one of the people that's involved with psychedelic therapy work, I
okay.
believe. So that's pretty cool. And then you mentioned right at the outset Mary Porter.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really looking forward to what she has to say. She's the co-founder, I believe, and director of something called the Looking Glass Peyote Church,
yeah.
which is a sort of a spin-off of the Native American Church. It's sort of, you know, it's not the Native American Church, but
mm-hmm.
kind of similar in the way they do things, I believe. But one thing I'm really interested in about Mary is not just that she understands peyote as a spiritual medicine, but that she also has a strong connection and ability to articulate the vision for our urgently necessary return to, you know, who we are,
yeah.
if you want to call it that, right? The Earth People vision, or whatever
yeah.
you want to call it, she's tuned into that and she can articulate it. So
yeah.
I'm looking forward to her.
Because she,
yeah.
I heard her, not that I was at the Exploring Psychedelics,
uh-huh.
or not Exploring, yeah, Exploring
yeah,
Psychedelics.
Yeah.
Martin Ball uploads all of his talks, so I
yes.
heard Mary Porter.
Uh-huh.
And
okay.
very interesting in terms of, like, I think her church is one of the only churches in America, if not the only one, that exists under pre-colonial law. Oh. So she is allowed to administer peyote to anyone of any race.
Oh.
But the way that she does it as well is it's not just, oh, come and do peyote. You have to go do a 23andMe DNA test to see where your like DNA lineage comes from. And then in the high-dose peyote situation that you get put into, you experientially connect to your DNA lineage. So she, through her oral history from her grandmother and beyond, talking about their origination from the Siberian mountains, having a DNA test that says that, and then in her peyote experiences, directly experiencing the that trajectory.
Yeah.
So she'll have an interesting talk for sure.
And perhaps the last thing I should say about the conference altogether is that we also see this as a kind of community building, community development, strengthening, empowering kind of event where people can come and connect with each other, not just hearing people talk or whatever, but meeting people. And on the Saturday morning, one of the first things I'm usually the MC, is I usually say, hey, I don't care, it doesn't matter how shy you are, you know, in social situations, please push yourself beyond whatever boundary you have about that and walk up to total strangers and introduce yourself and find out what they're doing there, you know?
Yeah.
And there's a really good chance you're going to make some great connections that way.
Yeah. You know? Speaking of that, there's a lot of the time when Terrence McKenna would do his workshops, he would kind of end with, someone here has something that you need. Find the others. So this is a really good...
That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to remember that one for when I say that.
Yeah, find the others.
So at least one person here has something that you need. Find the others. That's good.
Yeah.
Are you going to come to the conference?
I am. I think I'm actually going to be doing an exhibitor table for Float House there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I'm really excited to be there, and hopefully maybe I'll see one or two of my listeners there.
That would be excellent.
That's probably a good way to end, but before we go, is there anything that you wanted to highlight? Any like website? You did just come out with a book called Cannabis and Spirituality, and if you're interested in that subject, I highly recommend picking it up. Is there anything else?
It's called Cannabis and Spirituality. I'm the editor and one of 18 contributors to it, and it's similar mission as the conference in the sense of hoping to move the conversation forward of understanding cannabis as an actual advanced spiritual medicine that needs to be learned, or, you know, if you really want to get the most out of this plant, that it has immense potential in itself to deepen your spiritual understanding if you really understand how to be with it, how to get out of your own way, how to give it the space to, you know, to do its thing, so to speak, and find the right dosage and strain and, you know, blah, blah, all that stuff, right? So there's a lot of variety on that, and so I think it's a very useful book. Of course, I'm biased. But,
I think so, too.
It is a useful book.
A lot of perspectives embedded in it as well, which is great.
So there's a website for that where I've got a few articles, not just on that. I've transferred articles from some other things that are all about the psychedelics in general, and that's cannabisandspirituality.com. And then there's a Facebook group for it, and I'm always more than happy to have people to submit posts that I would, of course, approve or not approve, but almost certainly approve unless they're saying horrid things or whatever. and I would like to see people sharing their, you know, their own personal testimonials, their understanding, and what they're doing, you know, because there are lots of people now leading ceremonial work with cannabis. There are churches starting up and things like that. So I'd like to see that Facebook group as a venue for sharing information that way.
A little network of information that can be
useful. And the conference, too, Spirit Plant Medicine is the name of the Facebook group for that. And the conference website itself for tickets for all those things I was talking about. Plus, I'll just briefly mention, for anyone who's in the Vancouver area, we have two pre-conference events, which are both going to be interesting. One is TJ Daw, who's been called the King of the Fringe for his highly interesting and insightful and funny and poignant one-man plays. He had one called Medicine a few years ago, which was wonderful. It was played at the Firehall Theater for 3 weeks, sold out every night, and was held over for another couple of weeks because it was so popular, which was a story about his stories kind of go all over the place, but they all kind of end up having their own kind of strange coherence. Mm-hmm. And this particular one led to him doing a week-long ayahuasca program with an ayahuasca shaman and Gabor Mate involved. So now he has another one called Burn Job, which isn't primarily about psychedelics, but it does include a description of his first LSD experience, which resulted in a field being burned down. I'm looking forward to hearing that one. So he's doing a pre-conference event for us, and these are super cheap, by the way. Mm-hmm. They're $10 online at the spiritplantmedicine.com. or $15 at the door, and that one is Sunday, October 15th, 3 p.m. At St. James Community Square. All the information's online. And the other one is also going to be really cool. I've seen this film. It's called Ayahuasca Reframed. Mm-hmm. It's an hour-long documentary, and the impetus behind that one is, again, how do we move the understanding of ayahuasca further effective ways into the culture, like legalization and getting it registered for religious use and therapeutic use, mm-hmm. and all that. So it's how to kind of make it legitimate and so on. But it's that sounds like a slightly dry topic, but it's actually a really interesting film. The cinematographer, we see him in a canoe going up into one of the tributaries in the Amazon. Mm-hmm. There's some very interesting stuff in that film, and there's going to be a panel discussion following it with Andrea Langwa from the organization called iSears, and Mark Hayden, who's a sort of boy wonder of psychedelic advocacy around here, and the chair of MAPS Canada. And Sohail Samimi, who's director of one of the local ayahuasca groups, religious groups in town here. And so that'll be fun too.
Excellent. And I think Canada is on the edge of some of those like religious freedom things in terms of ayahuasca.
I think some good things are happening. I'm not sure of the details, but mm-hmm. I think there have some hurdles been cleared. It almost happened during the Harper administration when the Harper government, if they deserve that lofty title, can't help but dig at Harper once in a while. They had been appealing for some sort of recognition for religious use of ayahuasca, and it had gone through the approval by the appropriate board, and if I understand it correctly, that level of approval normally would guarantee that it would have final approval. But when the Harper people found out about it, they just cut its throat. But apparently that something like that has been revived under this more sane government we currently have.
That's excellent. Well, that's a very poignant topic for sure then. Mm-hmm. So the Spirit Plant Medicine Conference is going to happen on November 4th
and 5th. If you're listening to this interview, you can use the discount code STEVE, all caps, STEVE, and you can get a $22 discount on the ticket price for the conference. I also really encourage people to come to it's a little bit expensive. It's $88 for the psychedelic comedy dinner, but it's well worth it. We're catering food in. We've got world-class comics that we're actually paying to fly up from California to come in and do this, and they're super funny, these guys.
Shane's definitely hilarious.
They're brilliant. But Adam, too. Adam has a play that has been held over twice in San Francisco called The Mushroom Cure, one-man show called The Mushroom Cure.
That's excellent,
And they both have this sort of they use themselves as fodder, mm-hmm. they make it pretty clear right away that they're both, they're a mess, but that the medicines have been, wonderful for them, all done in this, humorous way. Yeah.
Excellent. I'm really looking forward to that. I got to get my ticket, actually.
it's well worth it, It was $100 for the one at MAPS. And it was just well worth it,
Excellent. Well, I will have to go there for sure. Thank you so much again for the interview, and hopefully maybe one day we'll be able to do this sometime again, because there was a whole bunch of stuff that I didn't even get to ask you.
Yeah,
so
sure, anytime.
Excellent.
Yeah, I'm up for it.
Thank you so much.
Psychedelic people have had prophetic dreams, intimations, unlikely strings of coincidences, all of these sort of things. These are experiences which cultures deny. Cultures what doesn't fit inside the cultural paradigm is denied, marginalized, argued against. And we live at the end of a 1,000-year binge on the philosophical